my work is centered around this concept called blocks, and I coined the word blocks from what happens when you put a toy block in front of a baby. They'll be mesmerized by it. A toy block is relatively large to a baby. They'll be absolutely mesmerized by it. Any simple monolithic form with an intricacy inside it will magnetize attention. Art that lives in our collective consciousness in the most powerful ways, not the best, but in our collective consciousness, like Warhol or Van Gogh. If you walked up to an average person on the street that knew nothing about art, they might not recognize a Picasso, but they would recognize a Warhol and Van Gogh because it follows the same principles as a road sign. When it comes to life and death, we always use blocks. Bold, simple images with something that you can instantly understand. It's always a simple form, a circle, a square, a triangle, a rectangle, a hexagon, with an image in it that you can instantly understand before you have a chance to process. Any simple, monolithic form that you can understand before you have a chance to think will reflexively and mechanically magnetize our attention.
That's Jamie Mustard, author of The Iconist, set for release in 2019. We'll learn more of his theory on the economics of attention shortly. I'm Gregory Day, you're listening to pdxpodcast.com. Today's a double bill, as we also chat with Camus Davis, founder of the Portland Meat Collective and author of Killing It, an Education. In the following, Camus touches on some of the themes of the book.
The whole book is about me trying to get outside of my brain and to get outside of my headline thinking, magazine writer type, you know,
right,
thought process. I don't think we're that great at finding words to talk about death. And I think the vocabulary we do have comes from horror movies and sort of fundamentalist thinking about death. And so
it comes
not great.
Quite a bit,
it's pretty limiting.
Book.
Yeah.
The horror movie analogy.
Yes.
Something else you say in this book, doing something hard makes us better people. Where's this wisdom coming from? Is this something instilled by your parents? And your dad's a pretty tough guy. He's
yeah.
a hunter.
Is that
I mean, from your dad, that
probably,
kind of attitude?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm liking this guy.
Yeah, he's a good one. I came back from France with this sort of romantic notion of what it meant to farm, and the farmers I worked with had a very unique model. They owned every part of the process, and I
right.
thought, oh, why don't farmers do that here? And quickly met many farmers across the counter at Evo who had figured out maybe how to raise the animals, but they didn't own the slaughterhouse. They didn't do their own butchery. They didn't do anything. They sort of lost control after the slaughter, and also were facing a consumer base that was very different than the one in France. They couldn't find people to buy the whole animal who wanted to eat head cheese
right.
or, you know, brains or blood sausage or anything like that.
It's true. I mean, that's where the education comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, also, I mean, these farmers, they're quite competitive with each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Not like in France where they work together and use the same equipment,
mm-hmm.
what have you. So there are roadblocks.
Yeah, they're in a different, I mean, France is a capitalist society too in a way, but there's still a spirit of collaboration, at least in Gascony where I was, not in all of France. And the farmers here, yeah, are each buying their own tractor, they're each buying their own land, they're
right.
each paying for the slaughterhouse themselves, and, you know, they're wasting a lot of time and money because of that.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's really sad.
Mm-hmm. I was asked very early on in my conception of the Portland Meat Collective, before I had even launched it, actually, to speak about ethical meat eating, which was not even a term I had ever used or thought about.
Right.
And I was asked to speak about it next to a professor of philosophy and a law professor. And it ended up being an audience quite full of angry vegetarians and vegans. So it was my first indoctrination into that world.
I have to admit, I laughed quite a bit at these passages. You took a lot of abuse, and you took it on the chin. You held your own, I felt. And I got that from the passages. And at the end, animal crackers were passed down.
Yes, they were, ironically enough.
A good laugh at that, too.
I'm basically saying, okay, if we make decisions and we come to conclusions in a blink without thinking, then what I'm saying is, with my book, The Iconist, is how can you harness that blink every time? How do you grab that blink? Grab that blink by the tie and pull it into you. And this is really important because we live in a world so overloaded with content that we've become smaller. And this is scientific. You know, I call this concept dilution, where there's so much swirling around us right now that we've become smaller. We've become invisible. This is what I talked about at TED. And I give this example. We've become invisible. One example I give in my TED talk is in late 90s, 1998, there was a woman named Linda Stone who was doing research for Microsoft and Apple. And she coined the term, she was a tech executive, she coined the term continuous partial attention to describe how we're so overwhelmed with mass information that none of us are fully paying attention anymore.
Well, that's true.
And that was before all the social messaging and social media that we live with today. So if that was true in 1998, before Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, Pinterest, how much are we distracted today? Well, here's how it works. To the degree that you're distracted, Gregory, is to the degree that everyone around you is invisible. All right? And I can give you another example.
Yeah, being aware of your surroundings is kind of like a weird thing now.
Yeah, exactly.
You're always distracted by your phone.
But the flip side of that is that when we have a lot more anxiety as individuals and as a collective in terms of being able to get our message out and being able to get seen because there's too much.
Yes.
Like, and a good example of this is in 19. There's a great documentary out there where they give this information. And Wieden Kennedy's actually in this documentary called Art and Copy by Doug Prey. It's a love letter to the advertising industry. And he actually gives this information in the documentary. And there's lots of different people that have studied this. But one of the examples in that film and that I've also seen in my research is that in 1950, we were hit with you were exposed to about 250 advertising messages a day. By the late 90s, research estimated that the average human being was exposed to roughly 5,000 to 7,000. And that, with all the social messaging and social media now, it could be it's probably a lot more. So you couldn't process 1,000. So knowing that all of this choice is coming at you, how does that affect you? And that is the basis of a lot of my work. So that's why these laws of blocks become really important. When people have too much to look at, they're kind of pushing it out because they're so overwhelmed. You know, how can you harness attention in a world where people are so overwhelmed by messaging, content, and media that they're kind of reflexively pushing it away from them?
Now, this is something you're fascinated by because you have a background in economics. This isn't something that you're fascinated. Obviously, you're fascinated by this subject.
I am. And not just because I have a background in economics, but I do have a background in economics. I went to a school called the London School of Economics, where I specialize in economic history. So you could even call my work in certain ways the economics of attention. If there's only so much attention, how does that affect, or is there, if there's over information, how does that affect that we the way that we relate to that information, right? Well, if you dilute a chemical, it weakens the veracity or power of that chemical. So information overload, whether we realize it or not, weakens our veracity. But even, you know, more important than my background in economics is I have a background in being invisible. You know, I grew up in abject poverty. I moved to Eugene when I was 12. I spent the first 7 years of my life in institutional environments away from my parents on, you know, the drought-ridden, hot, monotonous streets of Los Angeles in a concrete, you know, jungle, really. And I, at that time, I was very invisible. You know, I'm ethnic, right? So I felt, and I had a lot of anxiety as a kid about being ever being relevant or ever being able to be seen. And so I'd finished my manuscript. I mean, this is how weird the world is. Before I'd realized that there was a connection between what has now become my work, my life, you know, my obsession, and my childhood. But it's very obvious to me now that the manuscript's done that the invisibility, that I found a way to kind of constantly transform myself and get people to take a look when I shouldn't have been able to. And I was kind of unwittingly using these primal laws that I came across, these natural laws, for years before I ever realized that there was a pattern.
Sounds like an epiphany.
There was actually a moment.
You had a moment.
Yeah.
You did get a letter from a vegan saying that you were the Dexter of murderers.
Yes, that was amazing.
Well put.
Thank you.
Did you keep that letter?
Oh, yes, I definitely did. I've kept all of them.
Kept all, even the bad ones?
Even the bad ones, yep. And there's usually more bad ones than good ones. But
why?
I think that the people who understand what I'm doing don't feel the need to vocalize that they understand, and the people who don't feel the need to vocalize that they don't understand or don't agree with it. So
right.
It's maybe a minority, but it's a vocal minority. And, you know, I appreciate them reaching out and telling me their opinions.
So much happens at the end of this book as far as your public persona goes.
Mm-hmm.
You got an award from Martha Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
And she gives you a great tip. I'm not going to give it away. But she gives you a great tip towards the end of this book.
She does, a very surprising one.
Did you have any other conversation with Martha that you didn't discuss?
I had one short conversation on the red carpet with her.
It's
and
a
that
great photo.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she comes from a family of Polish butchers. How about that?
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Nobody knew
I
that.
I loved finding that out.
This American Life featured a piece based upon your article on Bunnygate.
Mm-hmm.
Bunnygate was such a huge story. Was it a life-changing event?
It was. It was the first time that I really had to articulate why I do what I do in a very public way and to lots of people who did not like what I did or who misunderstood it. So that was intense. It was also scary. We were getting death threats, and one of my instructors was being followed. We had to get a stalking order. I mean, it was not fun.
No.
Yeah.
No, it's a big part of this book, the legal wranglings and what you had to deal with. It's unbelievable. And people you worked with, too, Levi, had to
mm-hmm.
deal with so
mm-hmm.
much of this. Can you tell us who Levi is?
He is a very good friend now, but back then, someone I had met in my magazine writing days, who is sort of an urban homesteader who has decided to take part in as much of the process of getting food to his table as possible. So he has his own bees, he slaughters his own animals, he raises his own chickens and rabbits, and has taught himself butchery and charcuterie, and so over time I hired him to teach a lot of my classes, including our slaughter classes.
Right, your classes. You talk about your classes towards the end of this book,
mm-hmm.
and the young kids, and getting them to get involved in their food,
mm-hmm.
what they eat.
Yeah, I've worked with some high schoolers to help them get closer to those processes and make informed decisions for themselves about whether they want to eat meat or not and what kind they
right.
want to eat. Yeah.
And where does the hamburger meat come from? That's a very
right.
interesting conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, and I think the more we talk about it, the more informed choices we make.
I was getting an education reading those passages because, I mean, if I have to be honest, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how
mm-hmm.
so much
Most
of what...
Most of us don't. Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah, and my goal is to get people to know how the majority of meat gets to our table, and then how a different kind of meat can get to our table if you're going to choose to eat meat. And I think knowing makes us more responsible consumers.
I was working at a PR firm in California, and the owner of this PR firm kept telling me that I should write a book because whenever I would pitch clients, they would sign. And I got really insulted. I kept thinking she was trying to get me to write a sales book. Okay? I was like, what am I, a used car salesman? And I remember I went on my way.
Hola.
Yeah. This place was in the South Bay near Redondo Beach. And I.
Oh, I know Redondo.
Yeah. So that's where the firm was. And I remember I went home early one day and I stopped in Westwood to have lunch at a vegetarian restaurant with an ex-girlfriend. And, you know, so what's going on? She's saying to me, right? I said, oh, well, you know, the owner of this firm is trying to get me to write a book. Like, I would rather write a sales book. I'm not going to write a sales book. And she said to me, this is 10 years ago. And she said to me, maybe it's not a sales book. And lightning went off in my head. I sped home down Wilshire Boulevard. And I sat down and wrote an 18-page outline. And the basic rules that I wrote in that moment have not changed. I've understood it more. I've understood it more in relation to stories. But the natural laws that I wrote, that I realized existed in that moment, were I wrote down, and not one thing has changed. I have a deeper, more sophisticated understanding of these laws now and how they fit into all every walk of life. You can use them to communicate to your kids better. You can use them to get people to pay attention to a resume, an email, a piece of architecture. And it was definitely art and architecture that had a huge influence on me even thinking in this way.
Well, you definitely sold me on this book. I need to buy this book. I love the promotional video you made for this. The lens flares kind of looks like J.J. Abrams.
The document on my website?
Yes.
Yeah, this incredible filmmaker named...
Beautiful video.
Yeah, this incredible filmmaker named Jelani Memory, right. Who's a friend of mine. He made that film as part of a contest that he was doing on innovation. And it's 3 minutes long, but...
Flickering lights.
Oh, yeah. It's such a good film.
That's tension. It really does.
He did such an amazing job on that film. And ironically, he's gone on to be... he was doing high-end film and video projects at that time for a lot of the brands around town. And now he's gone on to be a ridiculously successful entrepreneur. He's no longer making films. He is the chief creative officer and co-founder of a company called Circle, which I love because it's a basic shape, right? And I always like to—I always tease him and say to him, you know, I like to think that I influenced, you know, when you were working with me, I influenced your path. But his project is really cool. Like, he has this thing called Circle that helps parents. I don't want to use the word regulate. Basically, gives families back by he's got this hardware device that allows parents to manage the internet for the whole family, so they know how much time people are on it. They can limit the time. And so, you know, we've kind of, I gave this example in the Q&A at Fred. I mean, Fred? Did I just say Fred? David Ray is going to love that. Ted. I give this example at Ted where someone said, you know, because I talked a lot about invisibility and I talked a lot about dilution. And I said, you know, this person said in the Q&A, they said, how long has this been happening to us? And are we aware this is happening to us, that we're becoming invisible? And I said, I think that what's happened is so quick from the early to mid 90s to now that it's gotten overwhelming before we can have even had a chance to reflect as a society or a culture on what all of this mass distraction means. I mean, it's a massive cultural shift, and nobody has even begun to think about...
Books are coming out about this.
They are. I mean, and I'll give you an example of a really good one. So anyway, I give the example of, it's like the boiling of the frog. If you have a frog in lukewarm water and he jumps into it, and you slowly turn up the heat, he will boil to death. But if a frog jumps in hot boiling water, he'll jump right out, right? Or she. Could be a female frog, okay? Yeah, so a great book on this subject is another TED fellow and a best-selling author. His name is Barry Schwartz, and he wrote a book. He's a psychologist and a professor of social theory at Skidmore University. And he basically, he wrote a book called The Paradox of Choice, saying that having too much choice is actually causing psychological conditions, psychological manifestations. And here are the, here's what he says is happening. One is when we do a Google search, and there's tens of millions of examples, we don't know which one to buy, there's a million colors, so we have anxiety about choice. Or when there's too much choice, there's so much to choose from that we feel paralyzed about choice. We won't make a choice because we don't want to make the wrong one. And ultimately, this results in depression about choice and dissatisfaction, because we buy something and then we think, oh God, maybe I should have got the blue one. And somebody was telling me, and I don't know if this is true, somebody was telling me as I was giving that analogy in the last week that Rolls-Royce has actually developed a technology where when you want one, they put something like some sort of like screener over your face that registers your facial expressions. And as you talk, and they put all the choices in front of you, and they can somehow tell from your facial recognition technology what your favorite one is. But that gives you an example of this choice problem. So what I found is that invisibility, being diluted by all this information that's swirling around us, has similar psychological manifestations as choice overload. So when we feel invisible, when we're not sure we're going to be able to cut through, and recognition is a huge part of what drives us as human beings. It's a massive part of what makes us feel right in the world in terms of our lives, no matter what we do.
Oh, yes, okay. Definitely.
So I found that Barry Schwartz's explanation of psychological manifestations for choice overload is is exactly the same, really, for invisibility. When we feel invisible, we're not sure we're going to cut through, we have anxiety about cutting through. Or if we're not...
What that keeps coming up.
Yeah, exactly. Or if we don't think we're going to cut through, we won't do anything. Why try if I'm not going to cut through? So we're paralyzed. And ultimately, this can result in mental anguish, depression, and, like choice overload, dissatisfaction. We become dissatisfied with our lives if we can't get the recognition that we as human beings, as remarkable creatures, all deserve.
So you talk about your romantic life in this book,
mm-hmm.
And it had a happy ending.
It did.
Can you tell us about that? This isn't in the book, but
yeah,
I
made the choice to include some personal parts of my life in the book in order to help the reader think about what does it mean to sacrifice, to choose between one person or another, to be uncomfortable and to cause people pain and suffering, which
right.
Unfortunately relationships.
No, you're very frank and open
that.
About
yeah.
this in the book.
So in the book, there are two people that I'm sort of in love with and struggling with how to handle it. And in the end, I have to leave one to be with the other. And that, to me, is sort of an apt metaphor for a lot of the issues that come up in the meat debate in many ways. But yes, I do meet my future husband and... We just had a child, and here we go.
I want people to be able to communicate and get the recognition that they deserve, despite the fact that it's very hard to do these days with everyone being distracted and trapped, because I know what it does for people psychically and spiritually. And that is the primary goal and reason why that I've stayed. It's really hard. that I've stayed the course and do what I do.
Well, people want to hear solutions, and that's what you're providing, solutions for folks?
I am. I mean, I basically can say, let me give you a practical example, okay? In the 1950s, if you were to apply for a job, or if say you're an artist wanting to get into an art gallery, and you were to submit to that gallery or submit for that job, maybe you're among 50 applications through the classified ads. Today, an HR person or a gallery owner is looking at 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 applications. This is what I'm talking about when I'm talking about dilution. There's no way they can process that with the same intensity that they could if there were only 50. So that means you're invisible, right? So what I'm trying to do, and that is, that can create a tremendous amount of internal destruction, pain, and madness in an individual. So if you understand these primal laws, you can move your resume or your portfolio submission 3 inches to the left so that among 1,000, it's the one that the HR person or the gallery owner stops at. The ultimate reward is in what it, and again, Gregory, this is something I never talk about, so you're getting me to talk about the social aspect of what I do, which I never get to talk about. And the ultimate reward is the social aspect of what I do for the individual when they're able to get, when they're able to, amongst all the competition for attention around them, get the person to stop on them and engage with them based on these primal laws.
So the reward is connecting people.
The reward is connecting people. And, you know, there's a, one of the examples, another example I gave in the TED Talk is I talked about Abraham, you know, Maslow. And Maslow, Abraham Maslow was a psychologist in, and in 1943, he published his model of human motivation, which he called the hierarchy of needs.
Right.
And he talked about how there's like a pyramid of needs, right?
So didn't he come up with the term primal needs?
He might have. I'm not sure. But I mean, hierarchy of needs. He's another guy that talked about how motivation is a primary driver of the human condition or the human spirit. But he basically said that as we get above basic needs like food and shelter and belonging, we get into more complex needs like aesthetics or what he called self-actualization. Becoming on the outside who we want to be on the inside. Well, in order to do that, you need recognition.
And being aware of these laws just alone, wouldn't that make you feel a lot better?
That's a really good point. And that's one of the things that, again, nobody's ever asked me before. You know, the one thing I get from artists sometimes is, well, if I'm doing these laws, aren't you changing my work? And what I'll say to them is, no. I want you to look at these laws like a tool, like a paintbrush or a color you would use or a type of oil paint that you would use or a type of, what are those knives they paint with you would use. You could choose to use it or not to use it. This is just how people pay attention. So understand how people pay attention. So if you want attention, then you can move your work 3 inches to the left to get it. Because of the culture we live in, anytime somebody wants to help somebody else and you can't understand why they want to help somebody else, it makes your motivation look suspicious. Okay? That's just the way we are in Western culture. I don't think that people are that way in tribal culture. I think that's a Western culture thing. But I'll say this. The way, the antidote to that suspicion is sticking to your guns and not, and being unwavering in your effort to help. Right? So what ends up happening is when people say, God, that guy was helping people 5 years ago and he's still doing that, then people, that suspicion falls away.
That's who he is.
Yeah.
That's part of his identity.
Yeah.
Today's show was produced and edited by Gregory Day. That's me. If you'd like to contact me directly, you can reach me at greg@pdxpodcast.com. Love to hear from you. We'll be back in the middle of the week for a bonus episode, and also next Monday. We will see you then.